Hello, Interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe.
And I'm Justin.
Today, we're going to be talking about Andor Season 2, full spoilers in there. And just as an up-top disclaimer, we're going to be talking about some weighty topics that were explored in the show, like sexual assault and genocide. So, if you've seen the show, you probably know what we're getting into, but if not, you've been warned. So, Andor Season 2, despite a rocky start, depicts an intricately weaved universe which suffers under the tyranny of genocidal fascists and doesn't even need the Sith to make that feel scary. This is, for my money, no contest, the best written Star Wars of all time. It transcends its genre trappings to become a great show in its own right. But within the Star Wars frame, it's a lot in this show. There's all these nuances that I can't even really wrap my head around on a first viewing. I definitely need to rewatch this show someday. But getting into our medium shot now, what was your opinion of Andor season one, and I guess the first episode, because you didn't.
That's as far as I got was, yeah.
You didn't get to watch the rest with me because Justin doesn't have Disney Plus anymore, and I wanted to keep current with it, so
we watched things too fast for me.
And they come out three at a time this season.
Yeah, that was a little disappointing.
So the show finished in 4 weeks.
But the first season, I don't know, I enjoyed it. It was good. Definitely unexpected for a character that I was like, what? They're making a show about Cassian Andor? Huh?
Why this guy?
Yeah.
Of all people.
And then, I mean, most of the show's not really about him, but in the first season, but
he was generally considered to be the weakest character in his own show.
Yeah.
Which,
he's
to be fair,
almost like the B plot.
Yeah. He was a very well-written character, to be clear. It's just that the rest of the show is so interesting and so well-written that the main character sort of fell into the background because it's a matter of scaling. He is the boots-on-the-ground rebel who in season one was getting radicalized over time. He was not really privy to the big picture, which as an audience member is just inherently more interesting. We kind of want to see, oh, is Mon Mothma going to get her finances untied from Imperial scrutiny so she can fund the rebellion? What's Luthen's spy network doing? He's got his fingers in everything. He's talking to Saw Gerrera and Cassian Andor and Vel and Cinta and the Ferrix crew in season one. And like, we're very interested in Luthen because he's got a lot of things going on. Or Cyril and Dedra and ISB. Okay, these are like pretty big officers and pretty big positions of power. There's more of a macro sense going on. So the fact that Cassian is just seeing the real life perspective of most people in the Star Wars universe, it's no doubt interesting, but it's also, we're just kind of drawn to that big picture thing. And I think that's what separates the two of them and makes him feel more like a B plot. He just feels inherently less important, despite that kind of being the point of the show, is it's about the unimportant people coming to prominence. It's the average citizen that the Empire tramples under their boots until they become radicalized enough to fight back. That was the whole point of it, was that he wasn't an important guy. He was just a guy trying to make his way in the universe, as Han Solo said, and then kind of slides into this fight he really wanted no part of. And I think that's why he feels there's a balance struck in season two, because he is still arguably the most everyman out of everybody, but he's definitely moved up in the world, which, as you saw, even from the very first scene of the show, where there is a spy who he tries to enlist to help him steal an Imperial TIE fighter, and she's pretty nervous about her role in this caper, and he gives her a pep talk and convinces her she's doing the right thing. And even from that first scene alone, we see how far he's come from season one, how much he's matured and grown into this leadership role. He's not just an aimless wanderer anymore. He's a guy with clear-cut purpose and is starting to find the charisma to inspire others around him, prop up other every people in the Star Wars universe who were not unlike him that long ago. But he's not 100% of the way there, because as the next scene showed, he gets into the TIE fighter and immediately, oh, this is not what I was trained for. I'm kind of floundering right now. And his confidence pretty much goes right out the window.
I just love that he did it so confidently, too, that he's just like, okay, it's not even like he was like too confused. He's just like, boom. Oh, okay. This is not the same. Never mind. I don't know what I'm doing now.
Has to shoot his way out of the hangar bay and get out of Dodge.
It was just like the perfect sequence. He's so confident, 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 confident. And then he just backs in and goes backwards. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then he winds up on that planet with these, in Tony Gilroy's own words, band of idiots. One of them is actually played by Tony Gilroy's son. But this group of rebels had their leader killed, and now they are just trying to stay alive on this planet. And when Cassian finds them, they immediately assume he's an Imperial spy because he's, or just an Imperial pilot because he's flying a TIE fighter and wearing an Imperial jumpsuit. And why wouldn't this guy be Imperial?
Fair assumption.
Yeah. So they kidnap him. And that's the weakest arc of this show, I'm just going to say. It gets off to a rocky start when Cassian, who's clearly a cut above these idiots, it's like, oh, this is what most rebels in the universe are like at this point in time. They are absolute fools with two brain cells between them who lack a leadership structure or any kind of discipline in their craft. They're just aimless thugs who are fighting because they don't know how to channel their energy properly without that leadership. And maybe Cassian could have been somebody like that without the guidance of Luthen, for example. But even he was always a bit more crafty and smart in his own way. But just to see that arc, I believe, was mostly to see the gap between, oh, this is what a competent rebel soldier looks like under a proper rebel cell, and then ones that are just kind of there fighting for fighting's sake and infighting a lot of times because they don't, in the absence of the Empire, these guys are fighting amongst themselves, which is actually pretty smart when you look at the end of the season. Because when Cassian finally gets off that planet two episodes in, which was personally too long, but I can understand why they kept him there that long. They were trying to keep him away from all his friends for a long time. But at the end of this episode, he flies off the planet and we realize he's on Yavin 4. That was...
Oh, that makes sense.
When he they don't name drop the planet, but when he's flying off, we see that familiar red planet off in the distance. Just the skyline us Star Wars fans are so familiar with. And oh, this jungle moon was Yavin 4. Later to be the home of the Rebel Alliance. And then later on in Cassian, in Andor Season 2, we finally see the Rebel Alliance based on Yavin 4. And the irony is, the Rebels are still infighting there. Except it's a council of organized Rebels now. They're fighting over meatier topics, but they still, just kind of like these idiots in the forest who were fighting in early on, they still can't really get along. But there is more structure to it now. It's a step in the right direction. Still not perfect, but... And I think I'll talk about one of the interesting things about the Rebel Alliance this season is showing the difference between the Alliance and other Rebel cell operators in the universe. People like Saw Gerrera, who want nothing to do with this Alliance because he basically just sees them as... basically as tyrannical as the people he always fought. He never really cared for the Imperials or the Republic in its time. So he's like, why do I want to follow a bunch of old Republic senators like Bail Organa and Mon Mothma? Like, I don't really want any part of that either. Saw Gerrera's kind of always been on his own side. They just sort of have a mutual enemy. The surprising one for me was Luthen, because the Rebel Alliance and Luthen have this very tense relationship, where later on in the season, a lot of Luthen's key agents, like Vel and Wilman and Bix and even Andor himself, they all end up defecting to the Rebel Alliance because they're so sick of Luthen's lying and scheming and emotional manipulation of them that they think, we're just going to join the bigger cause. And Luthen, in his stubbornness with Clea, stays on Coruscant in the darkness and scrounges for the intel, same as he's always done. He absolutely refuses to come to Yavin and join the Alliance. And they all hate him for it because he's clearly the sketchiest one. But he's still sticking by his morals of, I will do the guy who does all the things that we all mutually hate. I will look like the bad guy, but I'm getting the job done. And all the rebels are, meanwhile, they're trying to sanitize themselves in a way. They're trying to look less like terrorists and more like an appealing option against the Empire. We're trying to look like the good guys now, and somebody like Luthen Rael does not give us that impression. Luthen is basically operating a band of terrorists who work in the dark, and it just, for propaganda purposes, he does not help the image of the Rebel Alliance. That is their big problem with each other. And it's just so interesting to me that most of Luthen's own agents, who he trained and brought up this far, they all converted. But a lot of them, to their credit, still have loyalty to Luthen. When Luthen calls, they get upset about it, but they answer multiple times this season. And even at the very, very end, when Luthen does die, by the way. And so when he finally dies, and Clea is on Coruscant and she needs to get out, it's Cassian who goes to save her, ignoring orders for to stay put. Cassian and Melshi and K2SO, they all go out to Coruscant and save Clea. And even she doesn't want to go to Yavin because, you know, she's so indoctrinated into Luthen's thing. Like, why do I want to go there? I'm not getting a hero's welcome. They're going to treat me like dirt because they all hate Luthen. And they kind of do when they finally get there. But that was what Cassian was trying to say. Like, hey, look, people don't like Luthen, but the Rebel Alliance, what they don't want to admit is they're only there because of all the sacrifices Luthen made over the years. The Rebel Alliance would not exist without the work Luthen put in to lay the groundwork. He was sort of the original organized rebel in the universe. And without him, you don't get these shining beacons of good on Yavin 4. He's the one who roped in Mon Mothma too, who ends up becoming leader of the Rebel Alliance and later, in canon, Chancellor of the New Republic. That was all because Luthen roped her in and guided her up to the point. And even, this one is a point of contention for Rebels fans, but even in episode 9, when Senator Mothma delivers her indicting speech to the Senate, where she calls out Emperor Palpatine by name as a genocidal tyrant and basically throws her reputation in the dumpster, that speech gets broadcast far and wide, and the ISB immediately comes for her. But they knew that this was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Bail Organa and his Gold Squadron were supposed to get her out. That's the narrative that Rebels told us as well. But what we don't know was ISB had a spy infiltrated in that. And Luthen knew this, because Lonnie is his informant. Lonnie is ISB, and so Lonnie told him that, okay, there's a spy in Bail Organa's outfit. It's compromised. They're not letting Mon Mothma get out of there. So he recruits Andor to save Mon Mothma. And episode 9 is all about, right after Mon Mothma's speech ends, Cassian gets up to the, infiltrates the Senate, gets up to the Senate floor, and basically extracts Mon Mothma from the Senate while ISB and stormtroopers are trying to shut the Senate down, and gets Mon Mothma to safety. And at the very end of that, the Rebel Alliance is basically like, okay, so nobody can know Luthen's squadron did this, right? For propaganda purposes, it has to have been Bail Organa's squad to have done this.
Yeah, because the way you're pitching it is that they wouldn't want to give any credit to Luthen's rebels, basically.
Absolutely not. So they basically say, oh, no, it was Bail Organa's squad that did it. And Andor and Luthen kind of just roll with that. Because, fine, we still did the job. And then we pick up where that episode of Rebels left, where she got off Coruscant and was taken by the Rebels crew to Yavin 4. So we do have basically an immediate sequel to that episode in the form of Rebels, which came out a long time ago, but set it up pretty nicely.
See, I don't see that being very controversial because it's just an addition to the information.
Yeah.
It applies to, we're connecting the roots of these shows together. Everything's not going to mesh perfectly, but to me, it sounds like they had a reasonable explanation for it. So
yeah, it was a bit of a retcon, and I think they showed a segment of a speech that Mon Mothma did in that episode, and you know, it was a different speech she delivered to the Senate, because Tony Gilroy didn't want to use that dialogue, he wanted to do his own, which, fine.
That's fair.
And like, you know, no offense to the writers of Rebels, but Tony Gilroy is the best dialogue writer Star Wars has ever had, so.
Yeah, he's not going to use, it would probably feel strange.
Yeah, it would feel pretty jarring. But, yeah, so they got Mon Mothma out, and I think, and that felt really weird of an episode to me, because this entire show, it kind of makes you realize, oh, we are, I don't know how many episodes in now, 12 plus 9, we're 21 episodes into Andor, the series at this point, and this is the first time Andor and Mon Mothma have ever met face to face. First, not the only time, because they do meet a few episodes later, but this is the first time in the whole series. And I see people online being like, oh, this feels like a crossover episode between two shows I really like.
When the A-plot and the B-plot meet, oh my god.
Yeah, it's just sort of a mind-blowing... And I also like how shocked Mon Mothma is by the brutality of everything, because her driver is an ISB plant, and she knows that. And then the driver, when Andor and Mon Mothma finally get out of the Senate, it's the driver who catches them, and Andor just shoots him dead right in front of her.
Whoa.
And she starts to have a bit of an emotional breakdown. And, oh, actually, sorry, it was before the driver, actually. It was the first time he shot somebody in cold blood was the ISB plant who pulled a gun on everybody and tried to get Mothma right as soon as she finished her speech. And she doesn't even know she can trust Andor. But then Bail Organa's guys, the compromised ones, start threatening people, and then Cassian just shoots her dead. And Mon Mothma starts to have this breakdown. She's like, oh, I'm not sure I can do this. And he just says, welcome to the rebellion. And that moment made me stand up and cheer. I'm like, whoa. I don't usually get an emotional reaction like that out of a scene, but I'm like, yeah, this is Mon Mothma's actual introduction to gritty rebelness.
This is what it's really like.
Yeah, because before that, she'd basically just been in her high society group, which was another big point for her in the first couple episodes. The first few episodes of hers were at the wedding of her daughter to the son of the crime lord that she set him up with, that she set her daughter up with in season one. Because that was her whole thing in season one, was I'm... to get my finances untied in a roundabout way, the only way to do that is if I marry my daughter off to a crime lord's son, which she feels awful about, but also kind of the theme of this show, sacrificing for the greater good. She's willing to do that. And not mother of the year, but it was that money would help fund the rebellion. And also, she never really seemed to think too much of her family when she did that speech, which she knew would make her a wanted woman, but it seems like at least her husband turned out okay. I guess the ISB didn't really go after them, but
did they explicitly kind of go into that, or
they didn't show her daughter at all? But her daughter, after she got married, just never appeared again. But her husband,
well, she's protected by a crime lord now.
Yeah,
she's good.
That's what I kind of figured. And her husband, in his last scene, was sharing a scene with that crime lord's wife. I guess they're having an affair now or something, and he looks like he's just sort of bored and unfulfilled and... Bless you. He just looks like he's bored and unfulfilled and kind of partying in life. That's just sort of how he ended up being, was just sad, mostly. And he doesn't even get dialogue after that. We just get like one shot further down the timeline of him. But I guess Mon Mothma knew they'd be okay. But the point is, she was willing all along to burn bridges for a greater good. But, oh yeah, so my point was early on. So at this wedding, her friend, her childhood friend, who was her financial advisor, basically.
Yep.
He is going through a divorce and he is starting to get... Basically, he's starting to see, well, you know, all my work that's been very dangerous, by the way, for imperial scrutiny. Everybody, like the rebels, you, we're at this wedding, it's fancy. Everybody seems to be benefiting off this but me, and I've got some debts to pay. So he basically starts blackmailing Mon Mothma. He's trying to extort her to buy his silence for his role in getting the funds.
Which they did imply in the first season that like
he's a loose end.
He wasn't the most not that he wasn't trustworthy, but she didn't want to tell him what the money was for to begin with.
Yeah.
Like she left him out on purpose until she was forced to in the first season.
Yeah. So at this wedding, Luthen is there and he catches wind of all this and he sends Cinta to take this guy Tay away. And Mon Mothma, this is her first inkling of what the rebels actually do, because she didn't even really know what was going to happen. Luthen strongly implies, we're going to take care of him, basically. And she kind of knows what that means. You can see it in her eyes that she knows what he might do, but she doesn't really want to believe it. So she kind of questions Luthen on that, like, what do you mean by that? And basically Luthen says, the fact that you don't know exactly what I'm talking about, how nice for you. I think that was his exact line.
That's great.
And then basically she just drunk dances the rest of the wedding away. And everyone's like, oh, I never expected to see Mon Mothma drunk dancing at a rave, basically.
I mean, she's giving away her daughter. She's trading away her daughter. She's getting rid of her childhood friend now. And there's not a lot going right there.
She just got blackmailed by her oldest friend or who's going to get killed. She's still on the hook for... She's getting deeper and deeper into this rebellion as time goes on. And so that was basically her story. Is finally seeing the reality of the rebel situation. Oh yeah, and even after they find her, they bring her to this apartment which Cassian and Bix lived in for the middle parts of the season. And it's just this little rundown Coruscant apartment where Luthen hides his spies a lot of times. And this is the first time she's like, oh, so this is how the other half lives. She's used to being in these fancy ball gowns and totally clean outfits and really ornate and beautiful production design places and palaces and the Senate buildings. Everywhere she is clean and beautiful, and now she's hanging around with these killers and rebels and perceived terrorists and in this rundown Coruscant apartment in the middle of nowhere, and she's just, oh.
Is this in like the lower levels then?
It's not that low. It's still, I mean, it's hard to tell with Coruscant, but it's not like a nice place comparatively. But yeah, so she's kind of finally seeing throughout this. I also like on the way out, Cassian puts his jacket over her to kind of disguise her a little bit, which I'm just now realizing is a nice bit of symbolism. She's draped in the jacket of a rebel soldier. In the at the end there, just before she gets carted off to Yavin. So, yeah, that's basically her arc of the season, is finally stepping into the rebellion full on. And even when the Rebel Alliance hates on Luthen, she's the only one who still had any sympathy for him, because she knows And even Cassian, when he's calling out all of the rebels in their council meeting, he's like, what? Like, none of you would be here without Luthen. None of you have even given a shred of his sacrifice, except maybe Mon Mothma. You know what I'm talking about, basically. But all the rest of you. One interesting thing this season, speaking of the politics side still, is they recast Bail Organa. Which is...
What? Why?
Interesting. Apparently, Jimmy Smits could not do this season because of scheduling conflicts, but they really wanted the character, so they recast him.
Hmm. That's interesting. I'm surprised they would do that with a character who's been pretty big lately.
Yeah, especially in this. Benjamin Bratt is his name. Yeah, so... And he was very good, actually. He plays a bit more of a grittier side of Bail Organa. A bit more no-compromising. A bit more... I think especially when you finally compare him to guys like Andor and Luthen, he looks like a hoity-toity noble sort of guy who's never really seen the fray in person. Who, you know, he kind of acts above them in many ways. He's still a very morally good guy, and he's the kind of person the Rebel Alliance needs. But when you compare him to somebody like Andor, there's a lot of friction between the two of them, especially when he's allied more with Luthen, and Bail's never really seen like guys like Luthen, which is also funny because Bail Organa was friends with the Jedi. Obviously, Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda, and Cassian this season shows a pretty clear distaste for the Force in general. There's a scene where this one lady, who's apparently some kind of Force healer, in a very, very low capacity, she works on Yavin, and she can only, like, make her powers work sometimes. And apparently Cassian, thanks to some bad experience his mother Marva had at some point in her life with a fake Force user, he's just kind of biased against Force users. He thinks the whole thing is a fraud. He's got no faith in that whatsoever. So when this woman comes up to him and tells him effectively, I can feel something important about you, she kind of gets the impression that he's messenger, was her word. And he just kind of, and there's something in him that when she's talking to him, he knows that she's right. He can feel something, but he's really going out of his way to try to deny that feeling because he really wants to believe it's all bull. Just all this religious element. And that's the first time in the entire, first and only character in the entire show with any Force sensitivity. And that doesn't come till like episode 9, 10, maybe even. It's really late into it. But this is the first time we see the Force in any capacity on Andor, which really fleshes it out. And of course, she's right. Cassian's entire life has been leading up to him being the messenger that gets the Death Star plans out. And that ends up, you know, this season does end up getting into the Death Star plans a little bit more. The great irony of Dedra Miro is that it's her fault. So basically, if you remember from season one, her whole thing is to try, I'm gonna get rid of Luthen. Or Axis is how she knows him. She is hunting down Axis like crazy. And then in the very end, we find out that she gets Director Krennic arrests her because he's like, okay, so the information that contains some stuff about the Death Star was found on your files, and those files were accessed by Lonnie, and Lonnie gave them to Luthen. And so now the name Death Star is out there, and she's like, why do you have access to that information? And Dedra was like, okay, because ISB is so constraining and everything is way too scrutinized, I had to break some rules and dig around in the dark for some information just to find Axis, because that wasn't her table anymore. There was another, her assistant from season one was on the Axis table, but she's trying to undercut him because she's like, that's still my thing. So she's just like still researching this stuff in the dark. And then like a packet arrives at her door by accident that just happened to have information about the Death Star, which is like perfect irony in this like super tight-lipped Imperial bureaucracy. It was a wrong delivery that happened to have information about Axis. She wasn't even looking into the Death Star. That packet just happened to have a clue about something Luthen did that ended up to her finding Luthen, which I'll get into in a minute. But the point was, it also had some Death Star stuff on it, which she didn't even care about. That was not the point whatsoever. She read it, but she didn't even care about it. But the fact that it was on her server that got hacked.
She leaked. So basically that ended up with the leaking of the Death Star plans.
Yeah. And that was one of the coldest lines from Krennic, where he basically said, if you're not a rebel spy, you've missed your calling. To Dedra Miro, of all people.
That's hilarious.
So Dedra Miro's story ends up with her on Narkeena 5, the prison that Andor was in season 1. And that's where she ends. In a cell. In an Imperial prison, out of the way.
Wow.
And yeah, she leaked the Death Star plans. Or at least the idea that there was a Death Star at all. Just the super weapon. That they didn't even know was a thing. So let's follow that thread a bit. So she leaks the information by accident. So Lonnie stole her access card, stole this information that there was a super weapon called the Death Star. Nobody knows what it does. We don't find that out. They don't find that out till Rogue One. But they get that information, and Lonnie tries to extort Luthen. Now, he says, okay, this is the big one. I got into that system, but now my cover is burned. So I need you to get my family off Coruscant safely, or I'm not going to tell you. And going back to this theme of sacrifice, Luthen in this moment realizes that Lonnie is not willing to sacrifice everything for the cause. So he does promise him safe passage to Yavin, and then shoots him dead off screen. But we find out pretty quick. So then Luthen has this information, but before Dedra gets arrested, before this is even kind of on her radar, she's following the thread to Luthen. So Luthen's burning all their intelligence data, and Dedra Miro confronts him in his antiquity shop. And it's just the two of them for this scene, and she's so cocky about it. She, you know, she's kind of playing coy at first, but like they both know what this is. Okay, you busted me. Okay. And then she's acting like, oh, I want to sell you an item of antiquity you might be interested in. She pulls out the star path from season one that put her on the path in the first place. And he's like, okay, sure. So she's getting cocky. She's gloating. Oh, I've imagined doing this in so many ways. She's getting so cocky, she doesn't notice Luthen kind of wandering off, and then he stabs himself. And then she's like, oh, crap, get the medical team in here. You're like, he's surrounded. Like, get the medical team in here. Save him. I need to, like, interrogate this guy to see what he stole. And then Luthen is dying in the hospital, and they kept him alive. And then Kleya finds out, oh, okay, Luthen got caught. But they already know they're burned. They were just about to get off Coruscant at this point. So then Kleya has to break into the hospital that's under ISB lockdown and Luthen's life herself, just so that he can't talk in ISB prison. There was no getting him out of there. He was unconscious. He was basically dead. They were just keeping him alive on life support. And then it's Kleya's the one who has to pull the plug.
I mean, he did try to end it himself anyways.
She just finished the job.
Yeah.
And what I liked about it was there was no grand speech or anything. Like that scene with Dedra was his last scene of dialogue. He stayed unconscious for his death. He just peacefully faded away. And most of that arc with that episode with Kleya was kind of going into her backstory with Luthen, where he originally found her. He seems like he was some kind of Imperial officer in the middle of a genocide, and he was having a bit of an emotional breakdown over it when he found this little girl in his ship who was hiding away from the genocide. And then he saved her and basically kind of became his surrogate daughter and basically raised her as a rebel from her youth. And it's basically just been the two of them forever. So he was basically a father figure to her, and that made it extra sad when they finally get to the end of the episode and she pulls the plug. Like, oh wow, they've been together a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And their relationship is pretty integral to season two. Just their... Clea gets a heck of a lot more to do. She's a very strong supporting character this season. I think one of her most intense scenes is when they need to get a bug out of the guy that... The gangster that is the father-in-law to Mon Mothma's daughter. They put a bug in his gallery, which is going to get caught soon. They have intel that, like, oh, he's going to be searching the gallery. So they have to get the bug out of the gallery. And they have this basically whole heist thing plan where they have to, like, get the bug out during a party. And that's a very intense scene. Just, like, Clea, like, the bug gets stuck and Clea has to, like, she's got this thing in her hand that's, like, trying to pull the bug out of its spot. And, like, her hand's bleeding, but she's got to, like, because she's so forcefully pulling on it, and they have to, like, Davos Galdin and Director Krennic and, like, all these people are in the room with them as this is happening.
Mm.
As they're having to get the bug out. But, like, Mon Mothma and Luthen are also there, so they're trying to keep the focus elsewhere. And there's a lot of... The show can get a lot of tension out of, like, these characters are basically just standing in place trying to pull something out of a table, but it's riveting tension that they drag out for just long enough to feel awesome. And yeah, so Clea gets a really strong arc this season too. I also really like how overwhelmed her and Luthen felt this entire time. There's a scene where Luthen basically breaks down with her and they're fighting because he's overwhelmed by the amount of lines they've laid over the years. He's like, I can't. It was because of the bug that they're like, I told you we never should have put that bug in there in the first place. And she's like, but you agreed to it. We're trying to get intel from everywhere. And he's like, I can't keep track anymore. I don't know what's where. I don't know what we're even doing anymore. We've got too many things on the go and I'm losing track of everything. And I think that also kind of shows, as a two-person operation that's very contained, Luthen kind of hit his breaking point because he tried to take on a lot alone. I don't think the Rebel Alliance really has that problem. They're less compartmentalized, maybe a little easier to infiltrate that way, but it's also they could share the burden in a way that Luthen was never willing to, and that's why he got overwhelmed and pushed to his breaking point. So what else happened this season? Oh, yes, the, you know, important thing this season. The Gorman Massacre. That was like a 6-episode arc. That was the whole thing. So, most of the season takes place on this planet called Gorman, which is basically Space France. In many ways. Even the tailoring, the culture, I think even most of the actors are French. And they, like, invented a language for this show that sounds very French, but also not. And even French speakers are like, this is hurting my brain because it sounds French, but it's not. They did a very good job with that. But basically, the Empire wants a special mineral on Gorman to build the Death Star. And they know that they can't really do it with the people there, so they basically are like, okay, we gotta find a way to get rid of the Gorman people. But the Gormans are, I don't remember if it was a core world or a mid world, they're like rich people, they're important.
I'm pretty sure they're a core world.
Yeah, they They're an important people to Galactic Society. It's not like they're doing this on a backwater world like Tatooine where nobody in the Republic really cares. Like, the Gormans are a known people. They're kind of like the galaxy's tailors for all the rich people.
Mm-hmm.
So the Empire's like, okay, so we got to find a way to force these people out. And a lot of the arc is basically, all right, so this is a multi-stage plan that's going to take place over many years, kind of spearheaded by Dedra Miro, actually, even though she shows some guilt at that. She came up with the idea and then immediately felt guilty. It was like, oh, I'm kind of architecturing genocide here, but it's going to advance my career. So, shrug. So basically, they're trying to turn the entire galaxy against Gorman so that by the time the Gorman operation actually goes off, nobody's going to pity them. They're going to say they deserved it, which is exactly what happens. Everyone was like, well, of course this happened on Gorman. The Empire just had to secure order when shit finally hit the fan. And that, so they basically built people's minds up in the media over very many years, got them comfortable with this topic that we shouldn't pity Gormans. And that led up, and then when their eventual genocide happened, nobody really cared. In fact, it was celebrated. And so then next stage of the plan is we put in Cyril Karn. And at this point, Cyra and Dedra are dating after season one. And I really love their relationship because, you know, they're the fascist couple who are actually pretty good for each other. She really likes control. He's always been kind of submissive and had no backbone. In his mother's words, he's delicate. They are a pretty good couple. And we do later, in most of the season, people are wondering, oh, is she, like, Dedra just throwing Cyril to the wolves? Is she going to give him up as soon as it's convenient? And we do later find out, no, she actually did care about him. And at the end game of this, she did plan to be with him. But she was also stringing him along, never telling him the full side of the story. She didn't send him to Gorman knowing he was inciting a rebellion that would lead to a genocide. He thinks he's baiting the rebellion by helping out this Gorman cell. And that's not what's actually happening, but that's what he thinks is happening. So Cyril infiltrates this cell, and he does actually start to get a sympathy for the Gorman people. He's lived and worked with them for over a year at this point. Even when his mom's calling him from Coruscant, being like, oh, I can't believe you're working with those despicable Gormans. He's like, it's not that bad here. They're nice. Like, you watch too much news, mom, basically. you're being lied to out there. It's not as bad as they say. So the outside agitators do come in the guise of Vel and Cinta, Luthen's agents, and they do help this cell take out a cargo shipment. No people were even on it. And Vel and Cinta were very clear, no weapons. We're the only ones allowed with weapons because you guys are not disciplined enough for that yet. You're just going to do exactly as we tell you, do the job. And then this young guy, he gets jumpy and a shot goes off at one point when, like, it wasn't even an Imperial who walked by. It was just a normal Gorman guy who we'd already seen was sympathetic to their cause. It was totally unnecessary to pull a gun on that guy and keep him away from the area when he was on guard. But then there's a struggle and then the gun goes off and it's Cinta who ends up getting killed. And then Vel is livid about that because she and Cinta had this back and forth relationship for a while, but they were like finally just about to get together. They were finally in a good spot. And then she just dies for absolutely no reason on a job that should have been easy.
Yeah.
And that embitters Vel for basically the rest of the season. I think that's what convinced her to leave Luthen, because Luthen was kind of emotionally manipulating the two of them for a very long time to make sure they didn't really get attached. At least that's the impression I got. He kind of did the same thing with Bix and Cassian, where it was like, your attachments are drawing your devotion to the cause, basically. That was always Luthen's mentality. Kind of Jedi-like, in a way. Oh, I forgot a step, though. Because before Vel and Cinta came, Luthen sent Cassian. And this is what set it up. Because Cassian, he infiltrated. And then he sees, okay, these people are ambitious, but they're like 10 years behind in terms of planning where Luthen is. He's like, yeah, they got some potential, but they're impatient. They are not really thinking of the consequences here. And Cassian's like, nope, I'm not helping you guys. I'm gone. And then Luthen is pissed at him for that. And then he tries to get Cassian to see the big picture. He's like, I don't really care if these Gorman rebels are unprepared. Because when they inevitably go up in flames, it's going to burn very brightly. And that could be the spark to bring more people into the rebel cause. Luthen's basically willing to sacrifice this whole planet. And Cassian's like, nope, I've done some morally sketchy things for you, but I am not helping these people kill themselves. It's not worth it to me.
Mm-hmm.
So Cassian steps away, and then he sends in Vel and Cinta, and then the job goes inevitably wrong, like Cassian knew it would all along, because he saw the lack of discipline there. And then it all comes to a head in the Gorman Massacre, where a bunch of these Gorman protesters, with the rebels who are sort of splintered through the crowd, they do have guns on them. The Imperials get some troops out, they start sending some riot troops out, and then there's an ISB sniper on the roof, and he fires. Not where you'd expect. He shoots one of the riot guards. And that sends the riot guards like, oh, somebody in the crowd just shot
us. Somebody did the first shot.
One of the Gormans did the first shot, obviously, because a riot guard went down. And then the riot guards start attacking the crowd, and the rebels in the crowd with their guns and Molotov cocktails, they start fighting, and then the stormtroopers who are all surrounding the place start firing on the crowd. And in the meantime, Cassian and Wilman, they're in the crowd too, because they're here to assassinate Dedra Miro. And it basically, all of Episode 8 just plays out. The Gorman Massacre, just concentrated in this square of the Gorman rebels fighting and the stormtroopers. It's full-on war in the streets. And then they send out the K2 units, and they're just tossing people like ragdolls. They're like whipping them really high into the air, and then they crash down on the street and break their necks. It's crazy. And it's just this massacre we're seeing play out. Now I got to cut to what Cyril was doing the whole time, because he was there too. And at this point, he sees all this stuff going on, and he has a bit of a breakdown, because he realizes, oh, this is what I was actually doing here the whole time. He did believe in Imperial order, but genocide's a bridge too far for him. He is kind of a lawful neutral guy at heart.
Well, if you think about like the first season, he was, I forget exactly how it played out, but he was in the interest of saving lives, not,
yeah,
you know, and that was what got him in trouble and got him demoted in the first place.
He likes Imperial order. He is a very much a proponent of the fascist state, but he doesn't, but not this side of it. And it's the side of it that he's been kind of hidden from up to this point. And it was like, oh, okay, I think I'm working for the bad guys now. So Cyril's wandering the streets kind of in a daze, just watching this genocide happening around him. And that's when he sees Andor with a sniper rifle about to take a shot. And I don't think he even knows he was going after Dedra. He just sees, my life is crumbling around me. This, like, everything I've worked for in my life is leading to a really, really bad thing. And then he sees the guy who started it all for him. He sees Cassian Andor.
I can finally catch him.
Yeah. The thing he's been, the guy who got him fired from his first job and has basically led his life up to this point.
Yeah.
On the worst day of his life, he sees his number one enemy. And then he basically blacks out and just goes into a, tackles him through a shop window, and they have this knockdown drag-out fight in the store. It's the best choreographed hand-to-hand combat I've ever seen in Star Wars. One of the best I've seen in a while, really. It's just, it's so brutal. And Cyril's really, he's really kicking ass. He's vicious. this is the guy he hates more than anything in the galaxy right now. And he's like, everything in my life is crumbled. If I can kill Andor today, it'll give me something. And Andor is, he's fighting this guy. He doesn't even really know who he's fighting because he didn't really see. He just got tackled and he's getting the crap kicked out of him. So then Cyril actually beats him. He's got the gun on Andor. And Andor just looks at him with confusion. He's like, who are you? And that's when Cyril realizes that the greatest enemy in his life doesn't even know him. And
he doesn't even remember him or know anything about him. Yeah.
He doesn't. This is the guy who ruined his life and who he's been after for like 3-4 years at this point. And he's inadvertently orchestrated this genocide too. And he's like maybe working for the bad guys after all. Like Cyril is just crashing very badly. And then the Gorman leader, who Cyril had been allied with for a while, the one who he was prompting in the rebellion, that guy comes in and just shoots Cyril in the head at that moment. And it's, for me, very, very sad, because Cyril is, he was probably my favorite character on that show. He was personally one of the ultimate everymen in a show about everymen. He was the guy who just really wanted to do his day job. He wanted people protected. He wanted good for his community and for his country, basically the empire in general. He wanted prosperity. He just wanted a safe and secure society. And he was never really a bad guy. He made some bad decisions, but he had good values on the whole. He was a bit of a mama's boy, but he was always kind and polite to people and never really had the backbone to stand up for himself. But he was just a dude who was good at his job and had some ambitions and never really saw how the system was pulling his strings until it was too late. And then he gets shot in the head right when he realizes it. And it's sad. And every time I see it, I'm like, look how they massacred my boy. And I think what got me nearly more than Cyril's death was when they're showing news footage of the Gorman massacre on the Imperial News Network, and Cyril's mother sees the carnage and starts crying because she realizes Cyril was there. And that got me too. Oh, now we got to see Edie crying about this, and damn it, all these connections are paying off. And on their way out, that's when they find, they hijack a tank and crash it into one of the K2 units, and that's, and then Cassian steals it, and that's where they get K2SO. Yeah. So, oh, and then there was Bix's arc in this one. That woman's just put through the ringer, man. Like in season one, she spent half of it getting tortured by the ISB. And then this season is like, oh, we're just kind of hanging out on this nice planet. And that was sort of a parallel about, they were sort of undocumented migrant workers is basically what they were doing on that planet. And then the Imperials start cracking down on people without visas. And then basically this immigration officer takes a fancy to her and tries to sexually assault her the moment he gets her alone. And that's a pretty brutal fight scene too. She's really having to fight this guy off, and she whacks him over the head with a metal bar and ends up killing him. But it wasn't an easy fight, that's for sure. And she fully calls it out as, he tried to rape me. I'm like, oh, that's weird in Star Wars, just hearing that called out. And then later on after that, she winds up an agent of Luthen, and in that period where she was at the apartments with Cassian, she kind of spiraled into drug addiction for a while. The drugs were mostly to help her sleep, but she was definitely dependent on them. And then she finally got a chance at revenge when she killed the guy who tortured her in season one. And after that, she seemed to heal a bit.
So she got her revenge, and then she's like, okay, now I can mellow out. I'm good.
Yeah, pretty much. And then she moved to Cassian to Yavin, and they had a good life together for a while there. And then after the Gorman massacre happened, Cassian thought, all right, I think I've given enough to this cause. This massacre makes me not want to do this anymore. So I think I'm going to go with Bix, and we're just going to leave. We've devoted a lot to this cause already. And then Bix kind of hears this hesitation and realizes, no, Cassian is where he needs to be. And maybe Luthen was right, and I'm the one who's holding him back. So she leaves in the middle of the night and basically says, well, I'm choosing for both of us. I'm choosing the rebellion. And after we win after all this is over, I'll find you. Which is extra tragic because being a prequel, we know he doesn't make it out. And the very last shot of the show is Bix and her little baby, and they're peaceful, they're in a good place, and the baby starts crying. And in that moment, I was kind of picturing, oh, I feel like in this moment the baby is crying is when Cassian died on Scarif in the middle of Rogue One. That's what my headcanon said. It just felt like something tied to that in a way. And this season, and just before that ending scene that's pretty peaceful, Cassian gets the mission that he's on in Rogue One. He goes off to find that informant, and then we basically play into Rogue One. And it sets it up very well. I was shocked that people actually survived this show. Half the characters I thought would all be cannon fodder, they made it out in some capacity and at least survived through to Rogue One. Will they show up later? Who knows? Some people have posited, oh, well, now that Endor's done, I kind of want a sequel series set after A New Hope, because obviously it goes into Rogue One. Let's just continue the Rebel Alliance show and set it between A New Hope and Empire. Keep going.
Eh. I feel like we've seen too much of the Rebels already.
Maybe.
We got this, like, there is a full arc there. There's not much more to tell that's different from the rest, I'd say.
Yeah.
Like, what's left to tell that would be interesting?
I can agree to a certain extent, but also I never expected a Cassian Andor show to bring this level of depth and nuance to the Star Wars timeline.
When it was initially pitched, it was like, okay, it was supposed to be about the formation of the Rebels. Okay, yeah. We haven't seen that before. I don't get why they're picking Cassian Andor to be the main character, but he's not really the main character anyways, so...
Yep.
That proved to be kind of false.
This show overall really did deepen just everything in the universe in general. It 100% makes Rogue One better. I just rewatched Rogue One the other day. I started A New Hope after that, but I couldn't finish it that day. I'll probably finish it later today. But it really adds context to everything in that era of the timeline. I kind of consider it to be what I'm calling the Death Star saga. Basically, from Andor season 1 and 2, he's building the Death Star, and like the plans are just like the name of it. Like, we get Krennic and all these things that are building up to the Death Star. And then Rogue One is when he finally fulfills his destiny and gets the plans out, and then A New Hope, the Death Star is destroyed, and all the sacrifices from everyone up from Cassian and Luthen, Mon Mothma, up to Luke Skywalker, everything mattered. Everybody we saw die, all these everymen who nobody ever knew their names before, and they didn't really get remembered in the grand scheme of the rebellion. Nobody remembers Luthen, but he was very integral to just the Rebel Alliance in general. It's the unsung heroes of the Rebellion, not the Force users or the great heroes and generals that are remembered by the New Republic era and the sequels. They're not the legends. But without them, the legends didn't get a shot. They basically teed it up so the legends could knock it down. And that's what Andor was all about. It was like, okay, Luke, Han, and Leia are great, but they didn't start their heroics on a blank slate. People were working before them for a very long time to make this happen. And not important people either, just regular people on both sides. And I think that also, it kind of humanizes the Empire at the same time, but also makes them even more threatening, because we see the atrocities they're capable of without Darth Vader and Palpatine ever present. Mentioned, yes, but never present. Like, yes, the Sith are behind this, but it's the everyday pencil pushers and administrators like Partagaz and Deirdre Miro who were doing untold amounts of damage. They're the ones who orchestrated the Gorman genocide. It was Palpatine's directive, but they're the ones who did it. And they probably would have done it anyway. Whoever on high said, we need these minerals no matter what, they worked to make this happen. Palpatine didn't personally start the propaganda machine. He didn't tell everyone in the galaxy to not feel pity after he committed genocide. That was all the people under him, just the regular workers of the Empire. And that thread all goes all the way back to season one as well, with, you know, I was just rewatching clips from the prison arc, like where they were just killing prisoners and that entire prison system. Like, that's under Palpatine's overall directive, but it's regular people running these prisons and committing these atrocities. And most of them we meet, they're not like mustache twirling evil. They're just guys who are doing their job and go home at the end of the night. And that's what Andor does very well. Like, we see Deirdre Miro in Cyril's apartment on Coruscant and have them, you know, overbearing mother and mother-in-law sort of deal with Edie. And they're just regular people on both sides. And that's one thing Tony Gilroy does very, very well, is he makes this feel like a lived-in universe. We see what the politicians are doing and the Coruscant and the back boardrooms of the ISB, but we also see, like, Cassian and Bix go shopping in one scene. We see, like, okay, this is just like a Star Wars grocery store. Okay, that's something different. Or, like, Imperial news broadcasters who are telling the story of total lies on Gorman, but they're just broadcasting news. Or we see, like, a morning talk show at one point. Bix is watching in the apartment when she's high and bored. We see other stuff, like just people doing their day jobs, like the bellhop who checks Cassian in to the hotel on Gorman when he's first investigating. And I got to mention that bellhop now, because a lot of people consider him to be kind of like the Kino Loy of this season in a way. Just the small character who really had very little to do, but kind of quickly became a fan favorite. And this bellhop is the one who tells Cassian the story of the Tarkin massacre. And he very clearly has a connection with Cassian, because Cassian sympathized in a way that he was not prepared for. And then later on in the season, a couple years later, when Cassian checks back into the same hotel under another alias, this bellhop recognizes him. And nobody else really bats an eye. He's like, oh, I kind of recognize you, and you're coming in under a different name. You were very in Sky last time. You're somebody different now. Okay, I see what you are. You're a rebel. And then when Cassian's leaving, the bellhop reveals, oh, I didn't even check you into the system, because anybody suspicious, my colleague there goes right to the Imperials. So, like, I got you. And Cassian asks him why he's helping him out. And the bellhop says, rebellions are built on hope. And that's the setup for the Rogue One where that line comes up multiple times. There's one point when in Rogue One when Jin asks Cassian what if what they're doing is going to be worth it, is it going to work even, and Cassian says, well, rebellions are built on hope. So Cassian parrots that to Jin, and then Jin,
so that's where he got the line.
Yeah, so he got the line from the bellhop, and then later on when the rebellion is doubting whether they should even go to Scarif in Rogue One, and Jin tells the whole Rebel Council, rebellions are built on hope. And at the very end of Rogue One, when they finally get the plans, and somebody asks Leia, okay, well, what do we even have here? And she says, hope. So it's the little things in Andor, like just this hopeful bellhop from a world that suffered a genocide that just talked to Cassian about his hope, ends up spiraling in a metaphorical sense all the way up to Leia Organa and the heroes we know. And it kind of, it's the little things that spiral, or once again, just like Deirdre Mira getting a wrong package at the door that ends up to the rebels hearing about the Death Star in the first place. Andor is all about the little stuff that spirals into the big stuff that Star Wars fans by and large remember, because those are the important things, but they all had a genesis somewhere. It's all about the little nuances of the universe that build into a vast tapestry of a beautiful, connected, messy universe. And nothing else in Star Wars does that as intricately and well-written and interestingly as Andor. That's why I'm strongly of the opinion that Andor is the best written Star Wars ever. It does lack that mythic feel of the originals. It does have that, you know, it doesn't have lightsabers or fantasy elements as much, or Jedi or that those kind of things. But in terms of just a political drama about a fascist universe and people getting pushed to their breaking point or being indoctrinated into rebel causes or building entire networks to fight tyranny, and everyone from the politics to a common thief finds their place in the grand scheme of things. It's very rare I've seen something like exactly like this. And the fact that it's Star Wars with its really rich built-in history and beautiful production design and classic sound effects and aliens, it just enriches what's already got the bones of an all-time great political drama. And it elevates it to a more entertaining status when it was already, like, if you set this here and now, it would have the same impact. The stuff the Empire does is no, their playbook is the exact same as fascist playbooks on planet Earth. We're just seeing it on a having it done on a Star Wars skin, which kind of makes both better. It makes Star Wars feel more grounded, but its heightenedness also removes it enough to still feel entertaining. It's not like somehow it's on the nose, but it doesn't feel like it at the same time. It's resonant entertainment, and I think that's the balance a lot of entertainment misses. A lot of things is trying to bash you over the head with messaging, and or it just feels smart. It feels like it's coming from a natural place and just saying, okay, well, this is how this is. This is how these things are done, and this is how people react to them. It just feels very natural in its setup and execution. It doesn't feel like I'm being fed a specific message and everything has to be conformed to make that message make sense. It's just, this is what it is, and everyone reacts pretty realistically from their positions to the issues at play. It's Yeah, and it's just so well made too. Everything from the production design, the costumes. I love Mon Mothma's costumes, the score, the dialogue, the actors are all brilliant. Everybody should win Emmys for this show. It's, yeah. Love Andor. One of my favorite shows, for sure. Especially now that I've seen the full picture. It's definitely a continuation of season two. And I'll criticize a little bit of it, for sure. Sometimes its pacing is pretty slow, and it's not... A lot of Star Wars fans will miss the action and the fantasy elements. I didn't need them. I stopped expecting them from Andor a very long time ago. A lot of people also get upset when, like, oh, well, you know, we wanted, like, Emperor Palpatine cameos. And I'm like, okay. But the show didn't need that. Everyone there mattered. Like, you got Bail Organa. That was more than a cameo. Like, you got original trilogy. And he wasn't an OT, but you got, like, legendary characters in there. But it felt natural to the story. He was there when he needed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You got the general, I don't know if he was a general or a corporal or what. Like, you got some of the leadership from Rogue One. They all were in here too. Like, these guys were in the movies, or at least that movie, at the very least. Like, they're in here when they need to be in here. And yeah, so it's not a perfect show, but it's pretty close to perfect, as far as I'm concerned. Especially as a complete package. They got their story. They got their, I think it's 24 episodes. Told a great story of indoctrination in the rebellion from a back alley brothel where he shoots two cops up to being a rebel hero and on Yavin 4 with a full-on alliance coming out of the shadows and getting the plans to a planet-killing superweapon. Meeting Force users at the very end, even really low-level ones. Just the show builds out the Star Wars universe over these 24 episodes from that little back alley up to those planet-ending stakes that just slowly escalate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brilliant piece of art just as its own unit, and I doubt Star Wars will ever do something quite like this again. But I can hope that they'll do something. Anyway. Yeah, any thoughts to share?
Huh?
Yeah. Okay, well, that's my thoughts on Andor Season 2 and a bit about Season 1. And okay, well, where can we find you?
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm.
And, you find me on Instagram at ThoughtPlane Media, and check out ThoughtPlane.ca for everything else we do. There's hundreds of posts for free, and you can donate a buck or two there if you like our work and you're feeling generous. We hope to see you on the next close-up with Ryan and Joe. And Justin, till next time.
Take care.